Okay, hello? Working? Sounds like it is to me. thank you so many people for turning up. That's really good. Slightly daunting, I must admit. This is me, Hume. You can call me Andy. The eagle-eyed amongst you will have spotted a bit of a conflict between what it says in all the documentation for this conference and this little blue logo. Well, not so little on these screens, but this little blue logo down there, which says The Guardian. All the documentation says I work for Clear Left, but it lies. I worked for Clear Left until about a month ago when I went to work for The Guardian. And before that, I worked at Bing on Bing Maps and other large client-side stuff. So that kind of brings you up to date with me, which you may or may not have been interested in. But let's talk about CSS for grown-ups. Or, as my friend Phil put it the other day, CSS for old people. And actually, he's kind of right, but I take it even further. It's like CSS for grumpy old people. Because this talk is kind of born out of my frustrations over the last few years, working with people to build websites, watching them write CSS, and with the best of intentions, follow all these best practices, but still end up with something that terrifies them. And it's almost a challenge to find a development team that's working on a code base that's more than a couple of years old, where the CSS isn't the most kind of frightening and hated part of that system. And the really frustrating thing is that I place a lot of the blame for this on these supposed best practices and the fact that they are so ingrained in our industry that it's taking years for us to shake them off. So I'm not really going to be talking too much about sort of flash, new, sexy CSS stuff. There's a panel tomorrow morning for that, which you should go along to. But hopefully I'll give you some food for thought around how we deal with building large sites with large teams that are constantly changing. And it's the sites that are constantly changing, but it's typically the teams as well. So a very quick poll, which may or may not work in this room, but who here writes CSS as part of their day job or as part of their... Okay. That's a good thing. So keep your hand up if you agree with the sentiment expressed by Alex in that tweet, if you can read it. Okay, that's less people. I guess that's a good start. So this is my thesis for today. I want to talk about the approaches we take to writing front-end code and writing CSS in particular. I want to look at a few of the best practices and, to borrow a phrase from Nicole Sullivan, explain why these best practices are killing us. And then I want to look at how we can improve our approach and methodology by looking at some of the principles that programmers and software developers more generally use to deal with the kind of problems that we face writing CSS. But first, let's take a little step back and look at where we've come from. So mainstream adoption of CSS very much piggybacked on the web standards movement back in the late 1990s and the turn of the century. And both web standards and CSS were playing a part in, I guess, a kind of increased understanding of the craft of web design and web development. There was a realization that code like this just wasn't going to cut it. It was unreadable, it's unmaintainable, it's brittle, we couldn't make it work cross-browser. And fundamentally, I guess, it was kind of breaking the entire concept of what it means to mark up a document with a markup language. CSS and the web standards rallying call that came with it was a means for us to break away from this. So in the case of this example, by removing presentational aspects of our code into a separate layer, so the beginnings of this idea of separation of content and presentation that became so important and is so important. And all of a sudden, we were kind of thinking about what we were doing. We were talking to each other, we were sharing tips and tricks, establishing best practice in this new and fledgling world. And one of my favorite examples of this is the CSS Zen Garden. For those that are a little bit newer to this and don't know what the Zen Garden is, it was created by Dave Shea back in 2003 to showcase the power of CSS, I guess. There was one HTML document, and you can see Dave's original design for it there. And people submitted new style sheets to provide a different design for the same HTML. And hundreds of these things were submitted with some really extraordinary design and extraordinary technical work done to achieve them. And of course, one thing that the Zen Garden helped to absolutely solidify in people's minds was this idea of the separation of content and presentation, a key part of this web standards message. And by definition, with the Zen Garden, you have a fixed HTML document, which made for a really interesting challenge. But at the same time, we kind of opened a bit of a trap door for ourselves by conditioning ourselves that we couldn't and almost idealistically mustn't add styling hooks into a document if we could avoid it. When we were building designs for the Zen Garden, we certainly weren't thinking about what it meant to create CSS for large and complex websites. We weren't thinking about what it meant to write flexible, readable, maintainable CSS, or what it meant to be working in large teams with multiple developers contributing code. But the Zen Garden isn't really a real-world situation. You know, it's one page where you can't touch the markup, and we're trying to create these really cutting-edge designs. That's an edge case at most in the real world. And yet, it informed huge amounts and generated huge amounts of our early best practice. And that's best practice that is still hanging on today. I guess there was also the kind of amusing myth that we might all be redesigning our websites without touching the markup. And again, in the real world, that doesn't happen, in case you hadn't noticed. So the overall pattern we were seeing was getting rid of anything that could be considered even vaguely presentational out of our HTML. We were obsessed with this separation of content and presentation at the expense of nearly everything else. Of course, we're trying to remove font tags, bold tags from a markup, but at the same time, we started trying to avoid presentational class names and IDs. People fought over what was the most clean, lean, semantic markup, and you'd be shunned from the community if someone pointed out you'd added in an extra class name that you didn't really need. And this is great in a nice sort of fluffy, altruistic, philosophical world, but in the real world, it's problematic. Because it got to the point where people were trying to avoid adding class names and IDs altogether. This was considered a worthy goal. And that is a best practice myth that is still doing the rounds today. The idea that adding an explicit styling hook to your markup is something to be avoided, despite the fact it has no impact on the semantics of the document, despite the fact it has no measurable impact on any end user, and despite the fact, if you did do it, you'd likely make your code much more readable, significantly clearer, and easier for people to work with. And I'm calling Andy out on this, not to criticize him. I love him, and he's done more for the web industry and continues to do more than I ever will. But just to demonstrate how ingrained and embedded this idea is as a best practice, but it's one of those best practices that is killing us. Because this is where you might end up when it's taken literally. And I've seen code like this, right? And of course, the final irony here is that this is done in the name of separating content from presentation. And yet, if I want to change the content or the order of the list items in my markup, I have to come and update the CSS as well, otherwise my Twitter list item ends up with a Facebook icon and so forth. And I'll touch on other examples like this in a little while, but the point is here, this CSS is completely reliant on the structure of the document never changing. So to do this in the name of separating content from presentation is lunacy. They couldn't be more tightly coupled. On the other hand, IDs and class names like that allow you to state exactly what a particular thing is, allow it to be much more easily reused in other parts of the document, in other parts of a website. It's clearly more readable. It's clearly more maintainable. There's a clear interface between the HTML and the CSS that's styling it. It's like an API into your document, an API that lets you style your document in the most efficient and simple manner. And when you have a tool that's as powerful and nuanced as CSS, simple is a really good thing. Because when it comes to writing CSS, there's one thing that we're really bad at doing. Because the mechanics of CSS are relatively simple, right? We have a selector, which targets a bunch of stuff. And we have a finite set of properties, which we can apply values to and make things happen to that stuff. Now, admittedly, there's kind of a lifetime's work in understanding what all those properties and values mean and how they manifest themselves in browsers to create boxes and layouts and styles. But that's not really the hard bit about CSS. That's not the bit that we're bad at. The bit that we're bad at is managing the complexity of all of this over a large site. And what I mean by managing complexity will become clearer as I continue, because it's kind of nebulous and doesn't really mean much on the face of it. CSS gives us an extremely flexible, expressive, and powerful set of tools for styling web pages. And the problem we've typically had over the years is that the minute someone fully understands this power, the minute they understand inheritance, specificity, the cascade, is the same minute as they go and hang themselves with that power. There's too much flexibility, freedom, power, and not enough constraints. And when we're building complex things, constraints are good. Because of that. Constraints are one way in which we can manage complexity. So to construct anything of a certain complexity, we need to be able to break things into its component parts, right? We need to be able to build a component and forget about it. If I create a product list component in my CSS, once I've built that, I don't want to have to think about what it is again. I just want to be able to take it, apply it in different scenarios, and have it work, never mind where it is in the document or where it is in the website. And I don't want other parts of my code base to be able to interfere with my product list. Nothing can get at its internals unless I explicitly tell it. So this is how complex things get built, right? Whether it's skyscrapers, bridge, you know, software that's running on NASA's computers or in hospitals or whatever, from small pieces loosely joined. And modern programming languages have dozens of features and patterns that allow programmers to manage complexity. They have things like namespaces and scope to help encapsulate pieces of functionality and stop outside things interfering with it. They have inheritance, mixins, things that help share common behaviors. Things like functions even, macros for reusing common functionality. CSS doesn't even have variables. Yet. CSS doesn't have anything built into it that stops someone coming in and blowing apart any piece of our carefully crafted code by adding one line pretty much anywhere. Somebody adds that, they think they've fixed their bug. Well, they probably have fixed their bug. But they walk away happy, and everything else blows up around us. And this means that as people putting code together, we need to make our own constraints. We need to build our own constraints into the system, into the way that we use the language. We need to find ways of writing code that means it's less likely for someone to come along and, you know, mess it all up by feeling they have no option to drop a specificity nuke like using important. We have to think about how we structure, how we organize, and how we architect so that we end up with quality code. Quality code that is maintainable and robust over time in the face of change. But what do I even mean by quality code? Well, there's a bunch of generic characteristics that we care about in any given code base, right? Things like correctness. Does the code actually do what it's supposed to do? Reusability. Can we take a chunk of it, repurpose it in other places, and have it work? And a whole bunch of things depending on what you happen to care about. But there's one thing we've come to care about ahead of all of those things. There's one thing that we need to optimize code for more than anything else, and that is change. The definition of maintainability is how easy is it to safely make changes to the code. And there isn't really anything I care more about than maintainability, seriously, even above and beyond correctness. Because at least if you have maintainability, but not correctness, at least you're in a position to make changes to help your correctness, to fix bugs without introducing new ones. And this is why people go on about readability, about clarity, simplicity, explicitness, because they are all fundamentally characteristics of a maintainable code base. And if you don't have maintainability, you're not in a position where you can confidently and safely make changes. It's harder and slower to add new features. You can't fix bugs. You can't work on other things that you might care about, like performance or scale. But CSS kind of has some anomalies, which often mean it's more difficult to optimize for change than it is in other languages. So this is a famous statistic that came out of Facebook a few years ago. Nicole Sullivan did some analysis of their CSS when she was working with them and found that there were 261 declarations of Facebook Blue across the code base. Now, Nicole kind of famously says CSS is not to blame, and I understand exactly what she means, and I agree with her broadly. But it kind of is to blame here, isn't it? Because Facebook Blue is a constant thing. It isn't changing. The fact that we've declared a constant, the fact that we've referenced a constant, 261 times in a code base isn't a problem in and of itself. What's a problem is that the value of this constant is stated separately 261 times. Now, that's a failing of the language, in my view, and it's one that has an obvious solution, which is come to be known as CSS variables, despite the fact that what we're really talking about is constants. Now, for a long time, there was a general feeling, certainly within the W3C, that adding complexity such as variables to the core language wasn't really needed. And this seems to be based on the idea that, firstly, complexity raises the barrier to entry, and secondly, that it makes it more difficult to easily reuse chunks or blobs of CSS in other scenarios. Now, and both of these things are true, and it does make sense to consider them, but over the last few years, I think there's been a consensus, certainly amongst people out working in the trenches of building large, complex websites, that we do need these kind of features. And a lot of this has been driven by the popularity and adoption of tools like these. Preprocessors such as SAS and LESS can help out in the areas of managing complexity and maintainability. And broadly speaking, I would say they are worth looking at to see if you think they can help you with problems you have or whether they will fit into your workflow. But they're not a silver bullet by any means. And actually, I'm not really going to touch on these much today because I think there's a broader problem around structuring and architecting CSS that these tools and also tools that we're likely to eventually get from the W3C won't help solve. I'm more interested in the discussion going on around the principles and methodologies that are coming out of projects like these. So rather than making changes and additions to the language that we use to style web pages, these projects help us think about how we use what we've got better. They're more about advocating a new set of best practices based on maintainability and scale and the things that we really care about when we're working in large teams on large websites. And the people behind these tools are people that have done exactly that, working on some of the world's biggest websites for Yahoo, Facebook, and the like. And if you're not familiar with these tools, I would recommend taking a note of the URLs and looking into the kind of principles that they advocate. So I'm going to put some code on these slides. I hope that's okay. But before I do that, I want to spend just a minute setting some context by talking very broadly about the ways that we split CSS up, just so we have a kind of common frame of reference. And I'm going to talk about this in terms of layers. So at the bottom of all of this sits our HTML document, the content and structure upon which we're going to apply these layers of CSS. And the first of those layers is what people often call base styles. So these are styles that are typically applied to element selectors. They go about setting up the core base styles of the page, things like font size and line height, link colors, heading styles, other typographical type of things. Above this sits what we'll call modules. So these are kind of individual largish components that sit on a page, things like a product list or a promo box or the main navigation. And finally, above that, the third layer I want to talk about is layout. Layout styles typically provide some kind of grid, allow you to lay out pages, set up columns, etc. Now, this isn't an exclusive list by any means. You might end up adding other layers of styling on top of these. For example, if you have something that skins or themes your site in a particular way, that's something you'd want to extract out into its own layer so it doesn't interfere with other things. But for the purposes of this, I'll stick broadly to these three layers of CSS and the HTML document, and talk about how they each individually contribute to the CSS system that we're building, but also how they interact with each other, or I guess specifically how they don't interact with each other. But just before that, there is one other thing we need to get over. Kind of, what's really so bad about this? This is the poster child example of a presentational class name, right? But we've talked about what makes a quality code base. We've talked about maintainability, and this kind of fits all those characteristics perfectly, right? It's clear, it's explicit, it's a beautifully sort of clean interface between the HTML and the CSS. And actually, what's the worst thing that could happen? Right, okay, so it's probably that. I think if this happens in your code base, you've got far bigger problems with the people in your team than getting them to write maintainable CSS. Seriously, there's no way that should happen. Now, I'm not necessarily advocating going and adding this kind of stuff to your CSS. But it's interesting. I think in many ways, this is actually like using the B and I elements as they've been repurposed in HTML5, where they have no semantic meaning. They're purely presentational, but actually they're sometimes quite useful. Well, this has no semantic meaning. It's purely presentational, and actually it's sometimes quite useful. Now, possibly not when there's a better class name that has more semantics that you could use instead, but the point is not to dismiss it because of some dogma. It isn't so bad, it really isn't. And if you buy that, the rest of these examples will be a breeze. Right, this is a far less contentious piece of code. You can breathe. So when we start from scratch defining a new module, a new thing, a new promo box in this case in our code base, we might do something like this, and all is well. It's reasonably standalone. Module is colored green up here. You can see green is a good thing. It's clearly going to inherit a load of styles from our base CSS, font sizes, colors, and the like. But you can apply that class name to anything in the HTML and understand broadly what you're going to get. But what happens when we start to develop this promo box module further and we write some code like that? So here we've made an assumption about the structure of our document, and things have gone red, which is bad. We've tightly coupled the module code to the structure of the document. We're assuming that an H3 is always going to be the semantically correct element for the heading in the promo box module. I'd rather not rely on the semantics of an HTML document never changing over time. Because when it does change, which it will, I don't want to have to update the associated CSS. And I don't want to compromise the semantics of my document by being forced to use an H3 because that's all my CSS supports. I want the document and the module to be loosely coupled. Sometimes you'll see, you know, this kind of thing in a stylesheet where people have extended the CSS to allow for that changing document. But clearly, we haven't solved the root of the problem there. We still have this tight coupling between the document and the module. And the worst outcome here is, you know, six rules, one for each heading. And once you've opened the door to that, people do it. It doesn't really scale. But this does. At this point, my heading can be anything. It can be any particular level heading. It can be any particular element. It can be an element that doesn't even exist in HTML as of yet. Now that's separation of content and presentation. And actually, when it comes to styling headings in general, I'm finding more and more that I'm avoiding heading selectors. So typically, we might create a number of heading styles in our base CSS so that they can be used throughout any part of the site, separately to any layout or specific modules. But the problem with this code is that there just isn't enough consistency and predictability in the HTML across a site. Different pages end up getting different structure, and what was an H3 on one page is now an H4 on another page, even though presentationally we want them to look the same. And this problem is, I think, exacerbated when you consider HTML5's new outlining model, which allows for levels of heading to be used very inconsistently, even within one document. So a saner way of dealing with this is to come up with your own naming conventions for headings that reflect the presentation of that heading, have no relation to what is going on semantically. So whereas once we might have had this, perhaps we'd be better off with something like that. So this is a simple naming convention that Nicole Sullivan recommends. I'm not personally a massive fan of it. I think it makes more sense to choose names that mean something within the context of the site that you're working on. Personally, I prefer that. Hopefully, it fits better to a kind of shared design vocabulary within your team, and people are more likely to understand it and adopt it. The more you can reuse shared terms like that, the better, I think. This is another very common example of where we needlessly tie CSS to document structure. So this is similar to the list of social icons styled with the nth child selector that we saw earlier. It's styling that's needlessly tied to the HTML. We've made an assumption that a product list will always be an unordered list. Well, let's face it, the minute we make that assumption is the minute that somebody comes along and decides they want it to be an ordered list. And there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to do that if it makes sense semantically. And of course, you can support it simply enough by removing the element from the selector. This is clearly more reusable and more decoupled piece of code. Although you'll notice that we're not quite green along the top yet. It's still assuming structure, right? It's still assuming lists. What's even more reusable is this. But this is kind of another one of those areas where people get frightened, because you could end up with something like that. And this is considered a bad practice, right? This is textbook classitis. There's no reason on the face of it for the markup to look like that. But it's a really reusable pattern, because now we can do loads of things with our product item class. Now, this may or may not be useful to you, depending on your requirements and the type of things you need to do in a given project. But it's a powerful and important idea. And what's more important is that you don't dismiss it because of some dogma from 2001 about classitis. If it's the right thing for your project, then it's the right thing for your project, and it's okay to break those rules. There's various other approaches, of course. You could potentially tidy the markup a little bit by doing something like that, but what you gain in tidier markup, you lose in simplicity, in my view. The simplicity of a product item being a product item across your code base. Now, there's another slightly tangential point to look at here as well, which is to do with performance. For various reasons, most browsers evaluate CSS selectors from right to left, so right to left. Yeah. So that means if the top selector here is used, for every LI element that the browser finds in the document and paints to the viewport, it has to check whether it's inside a product list as well. Whereas in the bottom selector, once it's matched that element with product item, there's no further selector evaluation to do. It can just grab the rules in that block and then move on. And if you ever look in any detail at the markup that Google generates in some of its more complex web applications, you'll see that pattern all over the place. Long lists where each item has a duplicated class name. It's textbook classitis, but it's done in the name of performance, and it's done in the name of flexibility of how they can use those patterns. I did have a few other slides on performance, but then I spotted that I think in this very room tomorrow at 11 o'clock, David Barron from Mozilla is doing a talk on CSS performance, so I would recommend going to that if you're interested. So we've looked at improving the flexibility of modules in general so that they can be more easily reused and optimized for change. But what happens when we want to start having whole new variations of a module? Perhaps a variation that sits in a sidebar. Now, this seems like a pretty reasonable approach on the face of it, and it's code that's all of us will have likely written at some point. But there's a couple of problems which can lead us down a dangerous road. So for a start, we've changed the module styles based on where it sits in the layout. So we've got that, as indicated by red, tight coupling between module and layout. Along with that, we're relying on the document structure again because we're targeting an ID which restricts the flexibility of this new module. And it doesn't matter where you think this module might be used or not used in the future. It isn't worth constricting yourself now to that being only available in a sidebar. So a useful exercise when you have different varieties of a module is to ask, well, what's actually different about this module when it's in the sidebar? Is it that we've got less space, so we want to make the text sizes smaller? Is it because the background color is different and we want to adapt to that in some way? Well, if it's the background color, now we understand a little bit more about what that module really is, why it needs to exist in its own right. So we can take our existing promo box and extend it to meet that requirement. So promo box light becomes a submodule of promo box. Now it relies on the cascade to override the styles of its base module, which means it has to sit after it in the source order. But that's fine. We should rely on the cascade in this case instead of complicating specificity, because we know promo box light depends on promo box. And actually, we could devise a pattern to make that even more explicit. So by using a convention in the class name like the double hyphen there, we're being explicit about the fact that promo box light has a dependency on promo box and must sit after it in the cascade. Here's another example of something that, as an industry, we went through a phase of embracing for a while, and that's overuse of page-specific styles. Now, there is some value in identifying what page you're on by adding an ID or a class name to the body, particularly useful around theming. But what it's never useful for is styling a particular module or submodule based on the page that it's on. Clearly, it ties the module code to the document code much too tightly. And let's face it, the minute you do this, the minute someone will want to use it somewhere else, and will end up with code like that, which simply compounds the problem. It's horrible to look at and not somewhere you want to be, particularly not when what you could have had was that. So get that right up front, and you don't have to touch the CSS again as the site evolves and as modules move around to different pages. So, in this brave new world of responsive design, we're obviously seeing a huge amount of use of media queries in Starsheets. And I think these can cause problems in certain scenarios. Media queries fit really nicely into our layout styles, right? They let us move columns about the place, drop things around, and change things as we have less room or as we have more room. It's when we start getting media queries in our module code that things can become a problem. So here we're trying to vary the layout of part of our module at a specific viewport width. But remember, this is a standalone module. It's a standalone promo box which we're supposed to be able to put in any layout, in any column, on any page. It has no business knowing how wide the browser is. What it really needs to know is how wide it is so that it can adjust its layouts within itself. So I've got a kind of more concrete example of this. This is a page with two forms on it, one in the main column, one in the side column. And clearly, we want these forms to share a set of styles. But when we've got enough room, we want to make the text size slightly bigger on the labels, and we want to pull the text input up onto the same line. But we don't want to do that by saying, apply these styles when the form is in the main column, or apply these styles when the viewport is over 700 pixels. What we really want to do is have some code like that. Because what we actually care about is the width of the module itself, not the width of the browser or what column it's in. All the module needs to know is, do I have enough room to pull up these text inputs and make the text size bigger? Nothing to do with layout, nothing to do with viewport width. And this way we can put the module anywhere, whatever column, whatever page, whatever browser width, and it adapts its display depending on its own context. It's responsive, but it's responsive to its local context rather than the context of, you know, some unrelated arbitrary thing like the viewport size. Now, unfortunately, this doesn't exist, right, this code. As you well know, you can't do this in CSS. But something like it can be reproduced fairly easily with JavaScript. So if we had some JavaScript that could add a particular class name once our module got above or below a certain width, then we could apply our new styles with a new, more specific selector, as shown there. So I first started playing around with this about 6 months ago, and since then, ClearLeft have used this on a few projects, both internally and for clients. It's a pretty small library, just over 2K before it's gzipped, and it lets you add new class names to a given element once it reaches a particular size. So in this case, we're saying if the width of the div is less than 400 pixels, then add the class name narrow. If it makes more sense, you can you can apply a rule to a collection of elements using JavaScript. And this code is available if people want to have a look at it and try and break it. I suspect there are some edge cases around how these elements measure their widths. But how it works is kind of irrelevant. The point is that the last thing I want to be putting in my nice standalone module is a reference to something like the size of the browser. By decoupling it in this way, we've made it more reusable and more flexible to potential change in the future. So we've already seen a few examples of presentational class names creeping in now, right? And we're kind of fine with that. It's good. Let's look at a few other examples that I personally find useful. And I call these little helper classes surgical classes because they sort of dart in and fix problems that we haven't been able to codify reliably within our CSS system. So these two provide simple surgical approach for adding standard margins to the top and bottom of a given element. Then we can use them to decide on a case-by-case basis how modules are spaced vertically. Because, frankly, it's just very difficult to declaratively in CSS say, when this module's above this particular one, we need a margin, but not when it's above this particular one, then we don't. But if it's below it, we do. That's very difficult to build a declarative system with those kind of rules. I mean, if you attempt that, you might double the size of your CSS, but you'll also likely end up coupling your modules together in a way that you don't want. It just seems to make more sense to apply that kind of thing on a case-by-case basis in the markup. And if we include these as part of our base style sheet, we know that they're widely available and we can use them as and when we need them. Similarly, these are a couple of helpers that do a similar thing for adding space on the left and right. And typically, you'd want to add these by wrapping your module in another div element so as not to interfere with the box model of your actual module or the box model of your layout grid. So these styles are there if they're needed, but we keep them hidden from the module code and we keep them hidden from the layout code. So in this example, not only have we cluttered our markup with presentational class names, but we've added some extra non-semantic divs as well. But I kind of don't care because it's helped us keep the grid consistent, right? It's helped us keep layout styles out of modules. And I think there are some other places where you can make a case for using these extra non-semantic elements. So here's how you might typically apply a sprited background image to show an icon next to a paragraph of text. And this works pretty well, except that because the background image is on the P element itself, you're limited in how you create that sprite and in the context of which you can use that sprite. And this is why you see sprited images with large amounts of kind of white space all over the place. It's because they're compensating for the fact that we don't really have control over the size of the element that we're applying that background image to. So what if we could decouple the icon functionality from the paragraph altogether? And we can do that by applying the background image to a new, different element. And by placing that element inside the paragraph, you have a lot more control and flexibility with how you sprite your icons and how you add them into various places in your document. And it seems to be becoming a convention to use the I element to do this kind of thing. I think just because it's sort of small and inoffensive, but it could be any non-semantic element like a span. And once we've done that, it's now easier to use in different situations, as well as inside the paragraph element at the top. We can reuse exactly the same I element elsewhere, such as in a link in the second example, which has its own different styling. An icon is now a standalone thing. It's not tied to being part of a paragraph or part of a link. It's its own thing, and you can use it in different contexts. And again, it's an example of breaking a supposed best practice, but the benefits, in this case, outweigh the very small cost. And Twitter Bootstrap implements this really nicely. It makes it trivial to add icons to all types of different elements. So the final area that I want to talk about is one that I'm increasingly convinced is the most important thing that we can do as front-end developers and as designers to help improve the quality of what comes out at the end of our jobs. The way that we package up code, not just to deliver to a third party or another development team, but the way we package it up for ourselves and our own teams and the broader organization that we're inside, makes such a big difference to the quality and consistency of an implementation. An implementation at the beginning of its life, but also over time as it changes. Now, a poster child for Web Style Guide, certainly in the UK, is the BBC's GEL guidelines, the Global Experience Language. And they've done a superb job, not only coming up with a quite distinct and stylish design language, I think, but one that translates really well across lots of digital environments, particularly the web. But what's missing from this, at least externally facing it's missing, is how this design language gets implemented in code. So they call this a web style guide, but it's a PDF download. And I'm not slagging it off because I think it's a superb piece of work on the face of it, but there's no question that the sites that implement GEL vary wildly in quality. And I think that's because there aren't guidelines that demonstrate how to translate these patterns into code. If you look at the code behind the sites, they're all re-implementing these things in different ways. They reinvent the details of how to create these components. And inherently, some teams do a better job than others. And when you're working on the web, in my view, the canonical representation of your designs has to be in code, and not in flat formats like a PSD or a PNG or a PDF. Because those formats are so far removed from what the web is that it just doesn't make sense. Twitter Bootstrap is a really nice example of where an organization's design language is documented in code and not in flat design comps. So this shows a page documenting how to use the base styles of Bootstrap, so the base typography you get and the default formatting of forms. This is another nice example. This is a style guide created by Paul Lloyd for his personal site, paulrobertlloyd.com. And again, it's detailing base style, including pretty much every plausible element that he might want to use on his site, from headings, lists, block quotes, figures. It's all in there. And when we get down to the bottom, it's quite long. Then you'll see data tables and forms and buttons. And this not only documents exactly what these elements look like with the base style sheet, but details exactly when they should be used and how. And if you've created something as thorough as this, then you know that if you take an HTML document that's well marked up, that's semantic, you're going to get something that is consistent and matches a known design language and a known style. We can apply the same idea to our next layer of CSS. So this is an example of a page that documents how our layout styles might work. It's one very simple page where anyone can come and understand how to implement columns within the grid that the design allows. It explains how to get the width, how to nest columns, things like this, and demonstrates in real life what might happen as you scale the width of the browser as well. And because it lives as its standalone thing, it reinforces that idea of the grid and the layout styles being separate from anything else. You don't need the base CSS to create this page. You certainly don't need the modules. And finally, we can look at how to document and describe different module patterns. So this example page shows every module required to implement this particular site, placed into a single column, so it's completely devoid of any layout again. It helps prove that these standalone modules truly are standalone, and aren't tied to or dependent on layout styles. It's a liquid width page, so we can test how the modules respond to different widths. And as an added bonus, I guess, there's little snippets of code that let the person who is actually implementing the page templates take those modules and put them into any page, into any column that they need to implement the site. And you'll notice that this documentation and the module library itself and not describing anything in terms of pages. We want to keep away from the idea of pages for as long as we can. Because if you don't do that, you'll start building page-specific things and making decisions like the promo box looks like this, except when it's on the home page, when it looks like that. And that's when you start to tightly couple module code or promo box code to a particular page. So I said a moment ago that I think this kind of documentation and approach to delivering code is critically important. But why is that? Well, you can probably tell from the kind of things that I've been saying today that I come from a development background. It's a web development background, certainly, rather than a sort of pure computer science background. But the organizations and environments I've worked in have been very developer-driven. Tech startups and then Microsoft have been the bulk of it. This kind of documentation, style guides, module libraries, these things are the place where design and development come together. It's where the design language of an organization gets turned into code. And if you want that code to be of a quality where it can successfully implement that design language on the web, then building and documenting in this way is really important. It makes a real difference. If you get this design meets development touchpoint right, you fundamentally end up with a better product, in my experience. And that's why, as a developer concerned about code quality, I feel I have a remit to stick my oar into the way that we work with designers and to make sure that this kind of collaboration happens. And if you work in an organization that you think doesn't have enough collaboration between developers and designers, I think this kind of approach to style guides can help foster that kind of collaboration. Everyone knows Twitter Bootstrap now. If you say you want to create a Bootstrap for your organization, people understand what you mean, and they get excited about that, and they want to collaborate on it. This is the reason one of the first things I'm working on at The Guardian is implementing exactly this. It's a project that documents how The Guardian's globally recognized style and design language gets implemented on the web. And it doesn't document it in Photoshop or InDesign. It documents it in code in a web browser. And when we want to change it, we change it in code in a web browser. And while we're talking about The Guardian, and because I'm pretty much done, and because they were very nice about me turning up for 5 minutes and then poncing off to Austin for a week, I promised I'd put them in a special slide, which I obviously spent much time on. The Guardian is growing its technology and digital team massively at the moment. If you want to come and help build these kind of things that I've been talking about for the next iteration of The Guardian's website in a responsive platform-agnostic world, then follow these links or have a chat with me. And that's it. Thank you very much. So we've got, just over 10 minutes, and I suppose there's two things we might want to do in that. One is get to the next thing that you want to go. The other thing, if people do have questions, I'm happy to hear what you've got to say. I would say let's try and keep them kind of focused, because nearly everything I've said has a kind of opposite and completely valid opinion in the other direction. And I love talking about all that, but I quite like to do it in the pub, which is where I'm going to go now until about Wednesday, I think. But if anyone does have a question, they keep it kind of focused and think it would be useful to people, that would be really good.
Hey, how are you thinking about how this applies to, files and, how many files your CSS should be in, or how you take a module that you're using in one part of your website and now want to use it on another part?
Yeah.
And, are you including 10 files in every page for every module or in, around that area?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. My take on that, which works for me, is that the stuff that I'm talking about here, I'm talking about completely independently from how you actually deploy it in a production environment. You can split your CSS out, obviously, into as many files as makes sense for you to work with it. And although that does get a little bit silly. but as long as when you actually deliver that in production, you wrap things up into the minimum number of files that you need, which typically might be one. But of course, that means you need a process around doing that, and that introduces some other complexity. I think if you're working in small teams where you don't have that kind of ability to do a sort of more complex build, then yeah, keep this to one or two style sheets.
Okay.
I can't really see, so.
Of all your experience, what would be the number one best practice to always keep in mind every day?
What is the one best practice, would you say? Is that what the question was? Okay. Okay, so very broadly, perhaps outside CSS, I think there's one thing that I have found works very well as a kind of base for everything that we do. And it's this idea of progressive enhancement, building things from a base layer that we know will work on the web and that will work in any environment that we stick it in on the web. And using that as the base for building great experiences on top of for browsers that can handle it. And it's really easy to forget that and say, well, we've got all this sexy new stuff that we want to use. Your implementation of that sexy stuff will be better if you've approached it in the right way, if you've approached it from this progressive enhancement mindset. And I would say that's the one thing that I always fall back on. And I say that having worked on, you know, big, large, you know, 30,000 line JavaScript applications that, you know, rely on JavaScript for the best experience. But if you still approach it in that way, you get great benefits, not just around how it works cross-browser, but around maintainability, around performance, so many things. Yep.
Quick question. Would you mind going back to the previous slide with those links? Just the Guardian, yeah, right there, the developers. Thanks.
These might be more appropriate for people that can work in the UK, although there is an office in New York, which is growing.
So I have a quick question about grids. I had an experience where I built out a page using Bootstrap's Twitter Bootstrap's grid system, and you know, span sevens and offset threes and all that. And then I went to optimize it for a mobile version, and I wanted things that were in columns to be, you know, on top of each other and everything. And I basically ended up throwing them all out in favor of semantic classes. And I'm curious, do you agree with that, or is there a better way I could have done that? Or
I think that's a tricky question. I think we're yet to find the kind of best practice around doing that. A lot of these grid modules or the libraries that help you implement layout, are still talking about, you know, 960 pixel width grids, but then we'll make a single column version when it gets down to, you know, below 320 or whatever. I think there's some really interesting work to be done in the middle around how we create a grid that is flexible, that we can use as a standalone thing, and that we can understand how those columns appear on the page, but that supports a little bit more kind of what we're doing in this responsive world with adaptive layouts and, you know, moving three columns down to two at one point and then down to one. I don't have any good answers. I've seen some interesting experiments people have done, but they've all been using preprocessors like Less, where they're building up different style sheets for different widths, but using the mixing features within the preprocessor to plug in the right styles for the right width. I think it's a really interesting area that someone will nail at some point.
First, thank you, because I've been doing this kind of thing myself and sort of agonizing over the fact that I'm breaking all of the, you know, best practices I've read about. But one question I have is, when you're working with something that's where the content is driven out of a CMS or something, how do you handle training people who are non-technical to work with some of these classes so they know to apply this type of header, you know, or things like that?
Well, I think that the first answer to that is that this is so much simpler for most people to understand than the world that we might have come from. So they should do a better job. You know, it's easier to put a class name on any element than it is to choose the right element. It's more explicit, right? And I think that's a big part of what makes this so powerful, is that different people with different levels of skill can come in and understand the system that we've created much quicker, because it's much more readable, it's much more explicit. There's less fuzziness over how it works. I think that's broadly the answer. Okay.
What's your view on extending a framework like Bootstrap versus creating your own? Like, what do you advise?
I think Bootstrap's really great for throwing together something that looks quite nice quickly. People almost using it as a, you know, starting point instead of the default styles in the browser. I think if you... Twitter Bootstrap's written for Twitter, right? It reflects their design language. It reflects the things that they care about. I would say create that for your own organization. You can certainly borrow concepts from things like Bootstrap or wherever, you know, as I have in these examples. You know, you could take their grid wholesale if that's flexible enough to work for you. But in terms of the actual design components, I would say create one that is specific to your organization and that it works within the, you know, it works within that environment in terms of the language that it uses and the design vocabulary that it puts together for you.
So do you have any thoughts on decoupling the presentation layer from the interaction layer, both with like JavaScript targeting elements and then, you know, extending your modules and so forth?
So I guess broadly speaking, much the same kind of stuff. I think everything I've said boils down to like just good practices around writing maintainable and readable code, and you can apply that anywhere. I think the thing that we haven't done is applied that to CSS for some years. In terms of the interaction layer here, I mean, I would say include interaction stuff in things like these style guides and module libraries, but make sure that they're decoupled in the same way as everything else is. And I think, to be honest, we've done a better job with that over the years with JavaScript anyway. The ideas of unobtrusive and, you know, that kind of approach to not coupling JavaScript too tightly to our document, we're already fairly familiar with.
Hi, I'm David Marland. I work on the BBC website, so I'm well aware of the JAL guidelines. And you've really struck a chord there in that, yeah, all we have is a Photoshop document, so I'm sure I'll be going back and telling people to provide some code. But with a big organization like the BBC, of course, it's designers versus developers quite frequently. Have you experienced that sort of problem in trying to get the designers to come and work in the browsers in their design?
Sometimes, I guess it depends on the background of the designer. I think there's no real substitute for, I don't know, I guess what I would call a web designer, a designer that understands what it means to design for the web. Sometimes that's missing, particularly in larger organizations where you have a more broad design team anyway. I think the way to fix it is to have a core web design function within the, you know, whoever's doing digital product development at the BBC. And they can obviously look at the organization's broader design stuff, but then they have to take it and make those designs work on the web. And designs to work on the web need to be in code. So. But I do think these kind of style guides and, you know, the Twitter Bootstrap thing, I know we keep coming back to it, but it's a really powerful idea and it's one that people understand. I think we're pretty much done on time. I'm getting an eyebrow. So thank you very much.